The Body, Cassette 2. 10. By the time we got across Beeman's Field and had struggled up the cindery embankment to the great southern and western main tracks, we had all taken our shirts off and tied them around our waists. We were sweating like pigs. At the top of the embankment, we looked down the tracks toward where we'd have to go. I'll never forget that moment, no matter how old I get. I was the only one with a watch, a cheap Timex I'd gotten as a premium for selling Cloverine brand salve the year before. Its hands stood at straight-up noon, and the sun beat down on the dry, shadeless vista before us with savage heat. You could feel it working to get in under your skull and fry your brains. Behind us was Castle Rock, spread out on the long hill that was known as Castle View, surrounding its green and shady common. Further down Castle River, you could see the stacks of the woolen mill spewing smoke into a sky the color of gunmetal, and spewing waste into the water. The Jolly Furniture Barn was on our left, and straight ahead of us the railroad tracks, bright and heliographic in the sun. They paralleled the Castle River, which was on our left. To our right was a lot of overgrown scrubland. There's motorcycle track there today. They have scrambles every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. An old abandoned water tower stood on the horizon, rusty and somehow scary. We stood there for that one noontime moment, and then Chris said impatiently, "Come on, let's get going." We walked beside the tracks in the cinders, kicking up little puffs of blackish dust at every step. Our socks and sneakers were soon gritty with it. Vern started singing "Roll Me Over in the Clover," but soon quit it, which was a break for our ears. Only Teddy and Chris had brought canteens, and we were all hitting them pretty hard. "We could fill the canteens again at the dump faucet," I said. "My dad told me that's a safe well. It's 190 feet deep." "Okay," Chris said, being the tough platoon leader. "That'll be a good place to take five anyway." "What about food?" Teddy asked suddenly. "I bet nobody thought to bring something to eat." "I know I didn't." Chris stopped. "Shit, I didn't either. Gordy?" I shook my head, wondering how I could have been so dumb. "Vern?" "Zip," Vern said. "Sorry." "Well, let's see how much money we got," I said. I untied my shirt, spread it on the cinders, and dropped my own 68 cents onto it. The coins glittered feverishly in the sunlight. Chris had a tattered dollar and 2 pennies. Teddy had 2 quarters and 2 nickels. Vern had exactly 7 cents. "$2.37, I said. "Not bad. There's a store at the end of that little road that goes to the dump. Somebody will have to walk down there and get some hamburger and some tonics while the others rest." "Who?" Vern asked. "We'll match for it when we get to the dump. Come on." I slid all the money into my pants pocket and was just tying my shirt around my waist again when Chris hollered, "Train!" I put my hand out on one of the rails to feel it, even though I could already hear it. The rail was thrumming crazily. For a moment it was like holding the train in my hand. "Paratroops over the side!" Vern bawled, and leaped halfway down the embankment in one crazy, clownish stride. Vern was nuts for playing paratroops. Any place the ground was soft, a gravel pit, a haymow, an embankment like this one. Chris jumped after him. The train was really loud now, probably headed straight up our side of the river toward Lewiston. Instead of jumping, Teddy turned in the direction from which it was coming. His thick glasses glittered in the sun. His long hair flopped untidily over his brow and sweat-soaked stringers. "Go on, Teddy," I said. "No, I'm going to dodge it." He looked at me, his magnified eyes frantic with excitement. "A train dodge, dig it? What's trucks after a fucking train dodge?" "You're crazy, man. You want to get killed? Just like the beach at Normandy," Teddy yelled, and strode out into the middle of the tracks. He stood on one of the cross ties, lightly balanced. I stood stunned for a moment, unable to believe stupidity of such width and breadth. Then I grabbed him, dragged him, fighting and protesting, to the embankment and pushed him over. I jumped after him, and Teddy caught me a good one in the guts while I was still in the air. The wind whooshed out of me, but I was still able to hit him in the sternum with my knee and knock him flat on his back before he could get all the way up. I landed, gasping and sprawling, and Teddy grabbed me around the neck. We went rolling all the way to the bottom of the embankment, hitting and clawing at each other while Chris and Vern stared at us, stupidly surprised. "You little son of a bitch!" Teddy was screaming at me. "You fucker, don't you throw your weight around on me! I'll kill you, you dipshit!" I was getting my breath back now, and I made it to my feet. I backed away as Teddy advanced, holding my open hands up to slap away his punches, half laughing and half scared. Teddy was no one to fool around with when he went into one of his screaming fits. He'd take on a big kid in that state, and after the big kid broke both of his arms, he'd bite. "Teddy, you can dodge anything you want after we see what we're going to see," but whack on the shoulder as one wildly swinging fist got past me. "Until then, no one's supposed to see us, you whack on the side of the face." And then we might have had a real fight if Chris and Vern, stupid wet end, hadn't grabbed us and kept us apart. Above us, the train roared by in a thunder of diesel exhaust and the great heavy clacking of boxcar wheels. A few cinders bounced down the embankment, and the argument was over, at least until we could hear ourselves talk again. It was only a short freight, and when the caboose had trailed by, Teddy said, "I'm gonna kill him. At least give him a fat lip." He struggled against Chris, but Chris only grabbed him tighter. "Calm down, Teddy," Chris said quietly. And he kept saying it until Teddy stopped struggling and just stood there, his glasses hanging askew and his hearing aid cord dangling limply against his chest on its way down to the battery, which he had shoved into the pocket of his jeans. When he was completely still, Chris turned to me and said, "What the hell are you fighting with him about, Gordon?" "He wanted to dodge the train. I figured the engineer would see him and report it. They might send a cop out." "Ah, he'd be too busy making chocolate in his drawers," Teddy said. But he didn't seem angry anymore. The storm had passed. "Gordy was just trying to do the right thing," Vern said. "Come on, peace."
"Peace, you guys," Chris agreed.
"Yeah, okay," I said, and held out my hand, palm up.
"Peace, Teddy?"
"I could have dodged it," he said to me. "You know that, Gordy."
"Yeah," I said, although the thought turned me cold inside.
"I know it."
"Okay, peace then.
Skin it, man," Chris ordered, and let go of Teddy. Teddy slapped his hand down on mine hard enough to sting, and then turned it over. I slapped his.
"Fucking pussy LaChance," Teddy said.
"Meow," I said. "Come on, you guys," Vern said. "Let's go, okay?"
"Go anywhere you want, but don't go here," Chris said solemnly, and Vern drew back as if to hit him.
11. We got to the dump around 1:30. And Vern led the way down the embankment with a paratroops over the side. We went to the bottom in big jumps and leaped over the brackish trickle of water oozing listlessly out of the culvert which poked out of the cinders. Beyond this small, boggy area was the sandy, trash-littered verge of the dump. There was a 6-foot security fence surrounding it. Every 20 feet, weather-faded signs were posted. They said, "Castle Rock Dump, hours 4 to 8 p.m. Closed Mondays. Trespassing strictly forbidden." We climbed to the top of the fence, swung over, and jumped down. Teddy and Vern led the way toward the well, which you tapped with an old-fashioned pump, the kind from which you had to call the water with elbow grease. There was a Crisco can filled with water next to the pump handle, and the great sin was to forget to leave it filled for the next guy to come along. The iron handle stuck off at an angle, looking like a one-winged bird that was trying to fly. It had once been green, but almost all of the paint had been rubbed off by the thousands of hands that had worked that handle since 1940. The dump is one of my strongest memories of Castle Rock. It always reminds me of the surrealist painters when I think of it, those fellows who were always painting pictures of clock faces lying limply in the crotches of trees, or Victorian living rooms standing in the middle of the Sahara, or steam engines coming out of fireplaces. To my child's eye, nothing in the Castle Rock dump looked as if it really belonged there. We had entered from the back. If you came in from the front, a wide dirt road came in through the gate, broadened out into a semicircular area that had been bulldozed as flat as a dirt landing strip, and then ended abruptly at the edge of the dumping pit. The pump, Teddy and Vern were currently standing there and squabbling about who was going to prime it, was at the back of this great pit. It was maybe 80 feet deep and filled with all the American things that get empty, wear out, or just don't work anymore. There was so much stuff that my eyes hurt just looking at it. Or maybe it was your brain that actually hurt because it could never quite decide what your eye should stop on. Then your eye would stop or be stopped by something that seemed as out of place as those limp clock faces or the living room in the desert. A brass bedstead leaning drunkenly in the sun. A little girl's dolly
looking amazedly between her thighs as she gave birth to stuffing. An overturned Studebaker automobile with its chrome bullet nose glittering in the sun like some Buck Rogers missile. One of those giant water bottles they have in office buildings, transformed by the summer sun into a hot, blazing sapphire. There was plenty of wildlife there, too, although it wasn't the kind you see in the Walt Disney nature films or at those tame zoos where you can pet the animals. Plump rats, woodchucks grown sleek and lumbering on such rich chow as rotting hamburger and maggoty vegetables, seagulls by the thousands and stalking among the gulls like thoughtful, introspective ministers, an occasional huge crow. It was also the place where the town's stray dogs came for a meal when they couldn't find any trash cans to knock over or any deer to run. They were a miserable, ugly-tempered mongrel lot. Slat-sided and grinning bitterly, they would attack each other over a fly-blown piece of bologna or a pile of chicken guts fuming in the sun. But these dogs never attacked Milo Pressman, the dumpkeeper, because Milo was never without Chopper at his heel. Chopper was, at least until Joe Camber's dog Cujo went rabid 20 years later, the most feared and least seen dog in Castle Rock. He was the meanest dog for 40 miles around, or so we'd heard, and ugly enough to stop a striking clock. The kids whispered legends about Chopper's meanness. Some said he was half German Shepherd. Some said he was mostly boxer, and a kid from Castle View with the unfortunate name of Harry Hoare claimed that Chopper was a Doberman Pinscher whose vocal cords had been surgically removed so you couldn't hear him when he was on the attack. There were other kids who claimed Chopper was a maniacal Irish wolfhound, and Milo Pressman fed him a special mixture of Gaines meal and chicken blood. These same kids claimed that Milo didn't dare take Chopper out of his shack unless the dog was hooded like a hunting falcon. The most common story was that Pressman had trained Chopper not just to sick, but to sick specific parts of the human anatomy. Thus, an unfortunate kid who had illegally scaled the dump fence to pick up illicit treasures might hear Milo Pressman cry, "Chopper, sick, hand!" And Chopper would grab that hand and hold on, ripping skin and tendons, powdering bones between his slavering jaws, until Milo told him to quit. It was rumored that Chopper could take an ear, an eye, a foot, or a leg, and that a second offender, who was surprised by Milo and the ever-loyal Chopper, would hear the dread cry, "Chopper! Sick! Balls!" And that kid would be a soprano for the rest of his life. Milo himself was more commonly seen, and thus more commonly regarded. He was just a half-bright working Joe, who supplemented his small-town salary by fixing things people threw away and selling them around town. There was no sign of either Milo or Chopper today. Chris and I watched Vern prime the pump while Teddy worked the handle frantically. At last he was rewarded with a flood of clear water. A moment later, both of them had their heads under the trough, Teddy still pumping away a mile a minute. "Teddy's crazy," I said softly. "Oh, yeah," Chris said matter-of-factly. "He won't live to be twice the age he is now, I bet. His dad burning his ears like that, that's what did it. He's crazy to dodge trucks the way he does. He can't see worth a shit, glasses or no glasses." "You remember that time in the tree?" "Yeah." The year before, Teddy and Chris had been climbing the big pine tree behind my house. They were almost to the top, and Chris said they couldn't go any further because all of the branches up there were rotten. Teddy got that crazy, stubborn look on his face and said fuck that, he had pine tar all over his hands, and he was going to go up until he could touch the top. Nothing Chris said could talk him out of it. So up he went, and he actually made it. He only weighed 75 pounds or so, remember. He stood there, clutching the top of that pine in one tar-gummy hand, shouting that he was king of the world or some stupid thing like that, and then there was a sickening, rotted crack as the branch he was standing on gave way and he plummeted. What happened next was one of those things that make you sure there must be a god. Chris reached out, purely on reflex, and what he caught was a fistful of Teddy Duchamp's hair. And although his wrist swelled up fat and he was unable to use his right hand very well for almost 2 weeks, Chris held him until Teddy, screaming and cursing, got his foot on a live branch thick enough to support his weight. Except for Chris's blind grab, he would have turned and crashed and smashed all the way to the foot of the tree. 120 feet below. When they got down, Chris was gray-faced and almost puking with the fear reaction, and Teddy wanted to fight him for pulling his hair. They would have gone at it, too, if I hadn't been there to make peace.
I dream about that every now and then, Chris said, and looked at me with strangely defenseless eyes. Except in this dream I have, I always miss him. I just get a couple of hairs, and Teddy screams, and down he goes.
Weird, huh?
Weird, I agreed. And for just one moment we looked in each other's eyes and saw some of the true things that made us friends. Then we looked away again and watched Teddy and Vern throwing water at each other, screaming and laughing and calling each other pussies.
Yeah, but you didn't miss him, I said. Chris Chambers never misses, am I right?
Not even when the ladies leave the seat down, he said. He winked at me, formed an O with his thumb and forefinger, and spat a neat white bullet through it.
Eat me raw, Chambers, I said. Through a flavor straw, he said, and we grinned at each other.
Vern yelled, come on and get your water before it runs back down the pipe.
Race you, Chris said. In this heat, you're off your gourd.
Come on, he said, still grinning. On my go.
Okay, go!
We raced, our sneakers digging up the hard, sun-baked dirt, our torsos leaning out ahead of our flying, blue-jeaned legs, our fists doubled. It was a dead heat, with both Vern on Chris's side and Teddy on mine holding up their middle fingers at the same moment. We collapsed, laughing, in the still, smoky odor of the place, and Chris tossed Vern his canteen. When it was full, Chris and I went to the pump, and first Chris pumped for me, and then I pumped for him, the shockingly cold water sluicing off the soot and heat all in a flash, sending our suddenly freezing scalps 4 months ahead into January. Then I refilled the lard can, and we all walked over to sit down in the shade of the dump's only tree, a stunted ash 40 feet from Milo Pressman's tar-paper shack. The tree was hunched slightly to the west, as if what it really wanted to do was pick up its roots the way an old lady would pick up her skirts and just get the hell out of the dump.
The most, Chris said, laughing, tossing his tangled hair back from his brow.
A blast, I said, nodding, still laughing myself. This is really a good time, Vern said simply, and he didn't just mean being off limits inside the dump or fudging our folks or going on a hike up the railroad tracks into Harlow. He meant those things, but it seems to me now that there was more, and that we all knew it. Everything was there and around us. We knew exactly who we were and exactly where we were going. It was grand. We sat under the tree for a while, shooting the ship like we always did. Who had the best ball team? Still the Yankees, with Mantle and Maris, of course. What was the best car? 55 Thunderbird, with Teddy holding out stubbornly for the 58 Corvette. Who was the toughest guy in Castle Rock who wasn't in our gang? We all agreed it was Jamie Gallant, who gave Mrs. Ewing the finger and then sauntered out of her class with his hands in his pockets while she shouted at him. The best TV show? Either The Untouchables or Peter Gunn. Both Robert Stack as Elliot Ness and Craig Stevens as Gunn were cool. All that stuff. It was Teddy who first noticed that the shade of the ash tree was getting longer, and asked me what time it was. I looked at my watch and was surprised to see it was a quarter after two.
Hey, man, Vern said, somebody's got to go for provisions. Dump opens at 4. I don't want to still be here when Milo and Chopper make the scene.
Even Teddy agreed. He wasn't afraid of Milo, who had a pot belly and was at least 40, but every kid in Castle Rock squeezed his balls between his legs when Chopper's name was mentioned.
Okay, I said. Odd man goes? That's you, Gordy, Chris said, smiling. Odd as a cod.
So's your mother, I said, and gave them each a coin.
Flip.
4 coins glittered up into the sun. 4 hands snatched them from the air. 4 flat smacks on 4 grimy wrists. We uncovered. 2 heads and 2 tails. We flipped again, and this time all 4 of us had tails.
Oh, Jesus, that's a goocher, Vern said, not telling us anything we didn't know.
4 heads, or a moon, was supposed to be extraordinarily good luck. 4 tails was a goocher, and that meant very bad luck.
Fuck that shit, Chris said. It doesn't mean anything. Go again.
No, man, Vern said earnestly. A Gutcher. That's really bad. You remember when Clint Bracken and those guys got wiped out on Saroy Hill in Durham? Billy told me they was flipping for beers, and they came up a Gutcher just before they got into the car. And bang, they all got fucking totaled.
I don't like that, sincerely.
Nobody believes that crap about moons and Goochers, Teddy said impatiently. It's baby stuff, Vern. You gonna flip or not?
Vern flipped, but with obvious reluctance. This time he, Chris, and Teddy all had tails. I was showing Thomas Jefferson on a nickel, and I was suddenly scared. It was as if a shadow had crossed some inner sun. They still had a Goocher, all three of them, as if dumb fate had pointed at them a second time. Abruptly, I thought of Chris saying, I just get a couple of hairs, and Teddy screams and down he goes. Weird, huh? Three tails, one head. Then Teddy was laughing his crazy, cackling laugh, and pointing at me, and the feeling was gone. I heard that only fairies laugh like that, I said, and gave him the finger.
Hee, 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 Gordy, Teddy laughed. Go get the provisions, you fucking morphidite.
I wasn't really sorry to be going. I was rested up and didn't mind going down the road to the Florida market.
Don't call me any of your mother's pet names, I said to Teddy.
Hee, 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 what a fucking wet you are, LaChance.
Go on, Gordy, Chris said. We'll wait over by the tracks.
You guys better not go without me, I said.
Vern laughed. Going without you would be like going with Schlitz instead of Budweiser's, Gordy.
Ah, shut up, they chanted together. I don't shut up, I grow up, and when I look at you, I throw up.
Then your mother goes around the corner and licks it up, I said, and hauled ass out of there, giving them the finger over my shoulder as I went.
I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12.
Jesus, did you?
12. Different strokes for different folks, they say now. And that's cool. So if I say summer to you, you get one set of private, personal images that are all the way different from mine. That's cool. But for me, summer is always going to mean running down the road to the Florida market with change jingling in my pockets, the temperature in the gay 90s, my feet dressed in Keds. The word conjures an image of the GS&WM railroad tracks running into a perspective point in the distance, burnished so white under the sun that when you closed your eyes, you could still see them there in the dark, only blue instead of white. But there was more to that summer than our trip across the river to look for Ray Brower, although that looms the largest. Sounds of the Fleetwood singing Come Softly to Me, and Robin Luke singing Susie Darlin', and little Anthony popping the vocal on I Ran All the Way Home. Were they all hits in that summer of 1960? Yes and no. Mostly yes. In the long, purple evenings when rock and roll from WLAM blurred into night baseball from WCOU, time shifted. I think it was all 1960, and that the summer went on for a space of years, held magically intact in a web of sounds, the sweet hum of crickets, the machine gun roar of playing cards riffling against the spokes of some kid's bicycle as he pedaled home for a late supper of cold cuts and iced tea, the flat Texas voice of Buddy Knox singing, Come along and be my party doll and I'll make love to you, and the baseball announcer's voice, mingling with the song and with the smell of freshly cut grass. Count three and two now, Whitey Ford leans over, shakes off the sign, now he's got it. Ford pauses, pitches, and there it goes. Williams got all of that one. Kiss it. Goodbye. Red Sox lead 3-1. Was Ted Williams still playing for the Red Sox in 1960? You bet your ass he was. 3-16 for my man Ted. I remember that very clearly. Baseball had become important to me in the last couple of years, ever since I'd had to face the knowledge that baseball players were as much flesh and blood as I was. That knowledge came when Roy Campanella's car overturned, and the papers screamed mortal news from the front pages. His career was done. He was going to sit in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. How that came back to me, with that same sickening mortal thud, when I sat down to this typewriter one morning 2 years ago, turned on the radio, and heard that Thurman Munson had died while trying to land his airplane. There were movies to go see at the Gem, which has long since been torn down, science fiction movies like Gog with Richard Egan, and westerns with Audie Murphy. Teddy saw every movie Audie Murphy made at least three times. He believed Murphy was almost a god. And war movies with John Wayne. There were games and endless bolted meals, lawns to mow, places to run to, walls to pitch pennies against, people to clap you on the back. And now I sit here trying to look through an IBM keyboard and see that time, trying to recall the best and worst of that green and brown summer. And I can almost feel the skinny, scabbed boy still buried in this advancing body, and hear those sounds. But the apotheosis of the memory and the time is Gordon LaChance running down the road to the Florida market with change in his pockets and sweat running down his back. I asked for 3 pounds of hamburger and got some hamburger rolls, 4 bottles of Coke, and a 2-cent church key to open them with. The owner, a man named George Dussett, got the meat and then leaned by his cash register, one hammy hand planted on the counter by the big bottle of hard-cooked eggs, a toothpick in his mouth, his huge beer belly rounding his white T-shirt like a sail filled with a good wind. He stood right there as I shopped, making sure I didn't try to hawk anything. He didn't say a word until he was weighing up the hamburger. "I know you. You're Denny LaChance's brother, ain't you?" The toothpick journeyed from one corner of his mouth to the other as if on ball bearings. He reached behind the cash register, picked up a bottle of Soke cream soda, and chugged it. "Yes, sir, but Denny, he..." "Yeah, I know. That's a sad thing, kid. The Bible says, in the midst of life, we are in death. Did you know that?" "Yeah. I lost a brother in Korea. You look just like Denny. People ever tell you that?" "Yeah, spitting image." "Yes, sir, sometimes," I said, glumly. "I remember the year he was all conference. Halfback he played, yeah. Could he run? Father God and Sonny Jesus, you're probably too young to remember." He was looking over my head, out through the screen door and into the blasting heat, as if he were having a beautiful vision of my brother. "I remember. Mr. Dussett?" "What, kid?" His eyes were still misty with memory. The toothpick trembled a little between his lips. "Your thumb is on that scales." "What?" He looked down, astounded, to where the ball of his thumb was pressed firmly on the white enamel. If I hadn't moved away from him a little bit when he started talking about Dennis, the ground meat would have hidden it. "Why, so it is. Yeah, I guess I just got thinking about your brother. God love him." George Dussett signed a cross on himself. When he took his thumb off the scales, the needle sprang back 6 ounces. He patted a little more meat on top and then did the package up with white butcher's paper. "Okay," he said, past the toothpick. "Let's see what we got here. 3 pounds of hamburg, that's $1.44. Hamburg rolls, that's 27. 4 sodas, 40 cents. 1 church key, 2 pence. Comes to," he added it up on the bag he was going to put the stuff in, $2.29. 13, I said. He looked up at me very slowly, frowning. "Huh? 2.13, you added it wrong." "Kid, are you..." "You added it wrong," I said. "First you put your thumb on the scales, and then you overcharged on the groceries, Mr. Dussett. I was going to throw some Hostess Twinkies on top of that order, but now I guess I won't." I spanged $2.13 down on the Schlitz placemat in front of him. He looked at the money, then at me. The frown was now tremendous, the lines on his face as deep as fissures. "What are you, kid?" he said in a low voice that was ominously confidential. "Are you some kind of smartass?" "No, sir," I said. "But you ain't going to jap me and get away with it. What would your mother say if she knew you was japping little kids?" He thrust our stuff into the paper bag with quick, stiff movements, making the Coke bottles clink together. He thrust the bag at me roughly, not caring if I dropped it and broke the sodas or not. His swarthy face was flushed and dull, the frown now frozen in place. "Okay, kid, here you go. Now what you do is you get the Christ out of my store. I see you in here again and I'm going to throw you out, me." "Yeah, smart-ass little son of a whore." "I won't come in again," I said, walking over to the screen door and pushing it open. The hot afternoon buzzed somnolently along its appointed course outside, sounding green and brown and full of silent light. "Neither will none of my friends. I guess I got 50 or so. Your brother wasn't no smartass, George Dussett yelled. Fuck you, I yelled and ran like hell down the road. I heard the screen door bang open like a gunshot, and his bull roar came after me. If you ever come in here again, I'll fat your lip for you, you little punk. I ran until I was over the first hill, scared and laughing to myself, my heart beating out a trip hammer pulse in my chest. Then I slowed to a fast walk, looking back over my shoulder every now and then to make sure he wasn't going to take after me in his car or anything. He didn't, and pretty soon I got to the dump gate. I put the bag inside my shirt, climbed the gate, and monkeyed down the other side. I was halfway across the dump area when I saw something I didn't like. Milo Pressman's port-holed 56 Buick was parked behind his tar-paper shack. If Milo saw me, I was going to be in a world of hurt. As yet, there was no sign of either him or the infamous chopper, but all at once the chain-link fence at the back of the dump seemed very far away. I found myself wishing I'd gone around the outside, but I was now too far into the dump to want to turn around and go back. If Milo saw me climbing the dump fence, I'd probably be in Dutch when I got home, but that didn't scare me as much as Milo yelling for chopper to sick would. Scary violin music started to play in my head. I kept putting one foot in front of the other, trying to look casual, trying to look as if I belonged here with a paper grocery sack poking out of my shirt, heading for the fence between the dump and the railroad tracks. I was about 50 feet from the fence, and just beginning to think that everything was going to be all right after all, when I heard Milo shout, "Hey! Hey, you! Kid! Get away from that fence! Get out of here!" The smart thing to have done would have been to just agree with the guy and go around. But by then I was so keyed that instead of doing the smart thing, I just broke for the fence with a wild yell, my sneakers kicking up dust. Vern, Teddy, and Chris came out of the underbrush on the other side of the fence and stared anxiously through the chain link. "You come back here," Milo bawled. "Come back here or I'll sick my dog on you, God damn it!" I did not exactly find that to be the voice of sanity and conciliation, and I ran even faster for the fence, my arms pumping, the brown grocery bag crackling against my skin. Teddy started to laugh his idiotic chortling laugh, hee-hee-hee, into the air like some reed instrument being played by a lunatic. "Go, Gordy, go!" Vern screamed, and Milo yelled, "Sick him, Chopper! Go get him, boy!" I threw the bag over the fence, and Vern elbowed Teddy out of the way to catch it. Behind me I could hear Chopper coming, shaking the earth, blurting fire out of one distended nostril and ice out of the other, dripping sulfur from his champing jaws. I threw myself halfway up the fence with one leap, screaming. I made it to the top in no more than 3 seconds and simply leaped. I never thought about it, never even looked down to see what I might land on. What I almost landed on was Teddy, who was doubled over and laughing like crazy. His glasses had fallen off and tears were streaming out of his eyes. I missed him by inches and hit the clay gravel embankment just to his left. At the same instant, Chopper hit the chain-link fence behind me and let out a howl of mingled pain and disappointment. I turned around, holding one skinned knee, and got my first look at the famous Chopper, and my first lesson in the vast difference between myth and reality. Instead of some huge hellhound with red, savage eyes and teeth jutting out of his mouth like straight pipes from a hot rod, I was looking at a medium-sized mongrel dog that was a perfectly common black and white. He was yapping and jumping fruitlessly, going up on his back legs to paw the fence. Teddy was now strutting up and down in front of the fence, twiddling his glasses in one hand and inciting Chopper to ever greater rage. "Kiss my ass, Choppy," Teddy invited, spittle flying from his lips. "Kiss my ass. Bite shit." He bumped his fanny against the chain-link fence, and Chopper did his level best to take Teddy up on his invitation. They got nothing for his pains but a good, healthy nose bump. He began to bark crazily, foam flying from his snout. Teddy kept bumping his rump against the fence, and Chopper kept lunging at it, always missing, doing nothing but racking out his nose, which was now bleeding. Teddy kept exhorting him, calling him by the somehow grisly diminutive Choppy, and Chris and Vern were lying weakly on the embankment, laughing so hard that they could now do little more than wheeze. And here came Milo Pressman, dressed in sweat-stained fatigues and a New York Giants baseball cap, his mouth drawn down in distracted anger. "Here, here," he was yelling. "You boys stop a-teasing that dog, you hear me? Stop it right now! Bite it, Choppy!" Teddy yelled, strutting up and down on our side of the fence like a mad Prussian reviewing his troops. Come on and sick me! Sick me! Chopper went nuts. I mean it sincerely. He ran around in a big circle, yelping and barking and foaming, rear feet spewing up tough little dry clods. He went around about three times, getting his courage up, I guess, and then he launched himself straight at the security fence. He must have been going 30 miles an hour when he hit it, I kid you not. His doggy lips were stretched back from his teeth, and his ears were flying in the slipstream. The whole fence made a low, musical sound as the chain link was not just driven back against the posts, but sort of stretched back. It was like a zither note. A strangled yawp came out of Chopper's mouth. Both eyes came up blank, and he did a totally amazing reverse snap roll, landing on his back with a solid thump that sent dust puffing up around him. He just lay there for a moment, and then he crawled off with his tongue hanging crookedly from the left side of his mouth. At this, Milo himself went almost berserk with rage. His complexion darkened to a scary plum color. Even his scalp was purple under the short hedgehog bristles of his flat-top haircut. Sitting stunned in the dirt, both knees of my jeans torn out, my heart still thudding from the nearness of my escape, I thought that Milo looked like a human version of Chopper. "I know you," Milo raved. "You're Teddy Duchamp. I know all of you. Sonny, I'll beat your ass teasing my dog like that." "Like to see you try," Teddy raved right back. "Let's see you climb over this fence and get me, fat ass." "What? What did you call me?" "Fat ass!" Teddy screamed happily. "Lard bucket! Tub of guts! Come on! Come on!" He was jumping up and down, fists clenched, sweat flying from his hair. "Teach you to sick your stupid dog on people! Come on! Like to see you try!" "You little tin weasel peckerwood loony's son, I'll see your mother gets an invitation to go down and talk to the judge in court about what you done to my dog." "What did you call me?" Teddy asked hoarsely. He had stopped jumping up and down. His eyes had gone huge and glassy, and his skin was the color of lead. Milo had called Teddy a lot of things, but he was able to go back and get the one that had struck home with no trouble at all. Since then, I have noticed again and again what a genius people have for that, for finding the loony button down inside, and not just pressing it, but hammering on the fucker. "Your dad was a loony," he said, grinning. "Loony up in Togus, that's what. Crazier than a shithouse rat. Crazier than a buck with tickwood fever. Nuttier than a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. Loony. No wonder you're acting the way you are with a loony for a... "Your mother blows dead rats," Teddy screamed. "And if you call my dad a loony again, I'll fucking kill you, you cocksucker." "Loony," Milo said smugly. He'd found the button, all right. "Loony's kid, loony's kid. Your father's got toys in the attic, kid. Tough break." Vern and Chris had been getting over their laughing fit, perhaps getting ready to appreciate the seriousness of the situation and call Teddy off. But when Teddy told Milo that his mother blew dead rats, they went back into hysterics again, lying there on the bank, rolling from side to side, their feet kicking, holding their bellies. "No more," Chris said weakly. "No more, please, no more. I swear to God I'm going to bust." Chopper was walking around in a large, dazed figure eight behind Milo. He looked like the losing fighter about 10 seconds after the ref has ended the match and awarded the winner a TKO. Meanwhile, Teddy and Milo continued their discussion of Teddy's father, standing nose to nose with the wire fence Milo was too old and too fat to climb between them. "Don't you say anything else about my dad. My dad stormed the beach at Normandy, you fucking wet end." "Yeah, well, where is he now, you ugly little four-eyed turd? He went up to Togus, ain't he? He's up to Togus because he went fucking Section 8. "Okay, that's it," Teddy said. "That's it. That's the end. I'm going to kill you." He threw himself at the fence and started up. "You come on and try it, you slimy little bastard." Milo stood back, grinning and waiting. "No," I shouted. I got to my feet, grabbed Teddy by the loose seat of his jeans, and pulled him off the fence. We both staggered back and fell over, him on top. He squashed my balls pretty good, and I groaned. Nothing hurts like having your balls squashed, you know it, but I kept my arms locked around Teddy's middle. "Let me up," Teddy sobbed, writhing in my arms. "Let me up, Gordy. Nobody ranks out my old man. Let me up, goddammit, let me up." "That's just what he wants," I shouted in his ear. "He wants you to get over there and beat the piss out of you and then take you to the cops." Huh? Teddy craned around to look at me, his face dazed. Never mind your smart mouth, kid, Milo said, advancing to the fence again with his hands curled into ham-sized fists. Let him fight his own battles. Sure, I said. You only outweigh him by 500 pounds. I know you, too, Milo said ominously. Your name's LeChance. He pointed to where Vern and Chris were finally picking themselves up, still breathing fast from laughing so hard. And those guys are Chris Chambers and one of those stupid Tessio kids. All your fathers are going to get calls from me except for the loony up to Togus. You'll go to the reformatory, every one of you, juvenile delinquents. He stood flat on his feet, big freckled hands held out like a guy who wanted to play one potato, two potato, breathing hard, eyes narrow, waiting for us to cry or say we were sorry or maybe give him Teddy so he could feed Teddy to Chopper. Chris made an O out of his thumb and index finger and spat neatly through it. Vern hummed and looked at the sky. Teddy said, "Come on, Gordy, let's get away from this asshole before I puke." "Oh, you're going to get it, you foul-mouthed little whoremaster. Wait till I get you to the constable." "We heard what you said about his father," I told him. "We're all witnesses. And you sick that dog on me. That's against the law." Milo looked a trifle uneasy. "You was trespassing." "The hell I was. The dump's public property. You climbed the fence." "Sure I did after you sicked your dog on me," I said, hoping that Milo wouldn't recall that I'd also climbed the gate to get in. "What did you think I was going to do, stand there and let him rip me to pieces? Come on, you guys, let's go. It stinks around here." "Formatory," Milo promised hoarsely, his voice shaking. "Formatory for you wise guys." "Can't wait to tell the cops how you called a war vet a fucking loony," Chris called back over his shoulder as we moved away. "What did you do in the war, Mr. Pressman?"
"None of your damn business," Milo shrieked. "You hurt my dog."
"Put it on your TS slip and send it to the chaplain," Vern muttered. And then we were climbing the railroad embankment again.
"Come back here," Milo shouted.
But his voice was fainter now, and he seemed to be losing interest. Teddy shot him the finger as we walked away. I looked back over my shoulder when we got to the top of the embankment. Milo was standing there behind the security fence, a big man in a baseball cap with his dog sitting beside him. His fingers were hooked through the small chain-link diamonds as he shouted at us, and all at once I felt very sorry for him. He looked like the biggest third grader in the world, locked inside the playground by mistake, yelling for someone to come and let him out. He kept on yelling for a while, and then he either gave up or we got out of range. No more was seen or heard of Milo Pressman and Chopper that day. 13. There was some discussion, in righteous tones that were actually kind of forced-sounding, about how we had shown that creepy Milo Pressman we weren't just another bunch of pussies. I told how the guy at the Florida market had tried to jap us, and then we fell into a gloomy silence, thinking it over. For my part, I was thinking that maybe there was something to that stupid Gucci business after all. Things couldn't have turned out much worse. In fact, I thought it might be better to just keep going and spare my folks the pain of having one son in the Castle View Cemetery and one in South Windham Boys Correctional. I had no doubt that Milo would go to the cops as soon as the importance of the dump having been closed at the time of the incident filtered into his thick skull. When that happened, he would realize that I really had been trespassing, public property or not. Probably that gave him every right in the world to sic his stupid dog on me, and while Chopper wasn't the hellhound he was cracked up to be, he sure would have ripped the sit-down out of my jeans if I hadn't won the race to the fence.